Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming back to A Basic Conversation. I always enjoy my time here with Father Basic, and he's picked another easy theme for us to cover, and that is bridging the religious divide.
Yes, yeah.
I keep waiting for the layups to come, but they're not on the first go-around.
We have to choose controversial topics.
Okay.
They tell me that's what encourages people to listen. So.
That's the hook.
Yeah, right.
Difficulty, yeah. The vicissitudes of life, right?
It's got to be real. That's what I say. I always, when preaching, teaching, podcasts, whatever, I want to deal with an existential concern,
something
that's really in people's minds or hearts. Or if you can articulate it right, they say, yeah, I feel that way. Or if you could put it in the right language and say, yeah, you said clearly what I was feeling vaguely. Right. And so I always, the job of the theologian for me is to take the Christian tradition, rich and varied as it is, long history, great figures and so on, and put it into dialogue with real human life concerns, with existential questions, and see how the tradition can illuminate that particular concern.
Yeah. And I, tongue-in-cheek, said the layup, because religion theoretically should be a unifier, right?
Yeah.
Theoretically, but as we know, religion can be flashpoints for conflict, even wars, over the time of human history. So the interesting way that you divided up your lecture was you kind of broke it down to three: the division or the divide within the Catholic community, the division between Catholics and other Christians, and the last one was the division between the monotheistic religions, the big three, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So it was a really great organizer, and I think we'll probably spend most of our time talking about the divide or the gap within the Catholic community,
right,
we'll catch what we can in the other two bullets.
That makes sense to me.
Okay. So you had a really good, it was instructive to me that you said that from 1820 to 1920, the Catholics stayed together pretty good.
Yeah.
And it was pragmatics why they did.
Yeah, we had to. Catholic immigrants who came to this country, what was it? Did I use the figure 30 million?
33 million.
Yeah, who came in that period of time, they came into a waspish culture, fundamentally Protestant culture. And they were seen as people sort of unworthy of this new world. They had to deal with what we call the nativist prejudice. One of the historians said that the longest reigning prejudice in the United States was nativism. And they saw, all the stuff. The Catholics were dirty. They had too many kids. They gambled. They did bad things, and so on. And so that was very real. And they had to figure out how to make it in this country. It's one of the amazing stories that they did make it and rose above their circumstances. I always use that example right in Toledo, Ohio, on the Maumee River at the docks. There were signs, Irish need not apply, which could have easily have also said German immigrants or other Czechoslovakian immigrants need not apply. So it was a very real, the Know-Nothing political party that was explicitly anti-Catholic. So he had to deal with that.
And then leading up to Vatican II, and then Vatican II, then all of a sudden, some fissure started to develop within the Catholic Church.
Yeah, but let's go back and say the thing that allowed the Catholics to make it was largely World War II. Mm. World War II put Catholic men fighting alongside of Protestant men. They became friends and so on. Catholic women went to work in factories alongside of Protestant men and women, and especially the GI Bill. So the GI Bill was just absolutely crucial because the Catholics who came out of the war, got a chance to go to college because of the GI Bill, the federal help to be able to go to college. And that's why Catholics essentially, one of the reasons they made it. I mean, they did good in many ways. They worked hard and they became policemen, and they were got in political parties and were in part of labor unions. So there were a lot of factors, but World War II was big on making it financially. So Catholics became one of the more affluent groups in a WASPish country and overcame the nativist prejudice.
Right. And then you also, but Vatican II, though, didn't that start to create a kind of a traditionalist versus a progressive?
Yeah, it's a tough story. I mean, it's a complicated story for sure. Vatican II is crucial to the life of the Catholic population, yet today that occurred between 1962 and 65. Thousands of bishops met in Rome from all of them. They met for 4 years, and they eventually produced 16 different documents. And very often the documents were compromise documents. So at the council, two distinct, there were the curial officials represented by Cardinal Ottaviani, whose motto on his coat of arms was Semper Idem, which means always the same. So Cardinal Ottaviani represented, there's no change, we're not changing anything, you know, that. And they didn't want any changes, and they fought a lot of the measures. But you then also had more progressive bishops, especially from Germany and the Netherlands, great cardinals and bishops who challenged the curial people. So this might get too complicated, but when the bishops gathered, they had preliminary documents, and they were written by the curia. That's the Roman offices, all semper idem types, you know, always the same. So they wrote these very conservative documents, and the bishops got there, and they were expecting them to approve them. And Cardinal Alfrink and Frings and other great people, very first beginning of the council, said, no, we're going to talk about this. We're going to vote. We're going to vote who's going to lead this council. So the two wings were at loggerheads in Second Vatican II. And I must say, the progressives managed in many ways to get their way. Mm. In other words, the documents generally reflected the more progressive theologians. So while the bishops were meeting, my mentor, Karl Rahner, and Yves Congar, French theologian, were giving talks to the bishops. I mean, the bishops are not theologians, they're running dioceses, you know. So they had the great theologians in the world there to talk about the documents, you know, what are we going to say about the liturgy? How do you do Mass? What are we going to say about ecumenism? How we get along and all of that? So the theologians had great influence, and the progressive bishops won many points. Now, there were times they had to compromise, and Pope Paul VI often tried to make sure that the conservative voice was there. He didn't want to lose them. Right. He was a very he was in a delicate position, but he went out of his way to make sure that the conservative voice was at least heard.
Right. Yeah. And you use four ways to look, or descriptors of some of the divisions in the Catholic Church, and I think it was just in the United States, and you used the two types of bishops, the Romanists and the Americans.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have culture war. Or this doctor, let's go with that.
Yeah, the first one, yeah. Yeah, that historically, Catholics and the bishops who led them sort of took two views of the culture in which they were coming in as immigrants. One, represented by John Hughes of New York, was that the culture was not favorable for Catholics. It was too loose, too much sexual perversion, too much ecumenism. And so fundamentally, they wanted to avoid it. They wanted to fight the culture. Then there were people like John Carroll, bishops Ireland and England, said, no, this is a good country. We got it good here because we're free. Yeah. And there's a, we can build our own schools and we can do our own thing and nobody's stopping us from worshiping. And there's good values in this culture, especially the idea of freedom and of becoming a self-actualized people. So yeah, that those two things and probably are still at work in the
still
church.
At work, yeah. And you mentioned and the culture wars, which is kind of you touched upon, that was the second area.
Yeah.
And the third one was how people view Pope Francis.
Yeah.
Again, just trying to point out some of the division or different points of view in the church.
Right, yeah, it's a good way to approach it. Before I do the Francis thing, let me do the current culture war things.
Yeah.
So that has come to the head, especially on the abortion issue. And that's what, so the American bishops, largely appointed by John Paul II, to appointed bishops who thought like he did, and Pope Benedict appointed bishops who thought like he did, and they became, the preeminent moral issue was abortion. That's their language. It's not in the Roman language, it's not in the papal language, or the official documents, is a book called A Compendium of Catholic Social Teaching. And in that book, it does not say abortion is the preeminent issue. But that was our culture war. Bishop of the United States made it the preeminent issue. And they, to overturn Roe v. Wade was the great cause. They put all their energy, political capital, into that. They said very little about the environment. You know, other things that the Pope was, Pope Francis, has been interested in. So that's a way of distinguishing bishops yet today, those who are thought of as culture warriors, and they're going to they're rejoicing over the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and they want to overturn gay marriage possibility, and. And then there's others who see it differently and who are in more in line with saying, don't spend all your political capital on abortion. No, there's other issues. There's immigration. You know, there's climate change. There's racism and so on. And so let's have a across the board. Cardinal Bernardine used the phrase the consistent ethic of life. Mm. And so the consistent ethic of life says, well, we're against abortion and euthanasia, but we're also against capital punishment. You know, we're also against war. We're also in favor of helping the poor. We're also in favor of helping young women who don't have unwanted pregnancies to deal with it. So they have the resources they need. So yeah, there's still two really different tendencies in the Catholic Church yet today among the hierarchy.
So at some point, there was an acknowledgement that we have to try to come together, the Church and the Common Ground Project.
Yeah. Again, let me backtrack to your other point. I baptized your voice about Pope Francis.
Pope Francis, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of my heroes. Yeah. To get my own bias out. yeah, Pope Francis, I mean, he's like a witness to the gospel. He lives a simple lifestyle. You know, he shows compassion to people. He admits when he's wrong, apologizes for terrible things the church has done in Canada to indigenous people. You know, tries to reach out to people with dialogue and dialogue. Oh, he's just a wonderful witness, and I just maybe yesterday saw a stat that I wasn't aware of, but that I have used the line consistently over the years. That in his almost 10 years, he's maintained approval rating of around 82%. In the United among American Catholics, which is amazing, right?
Sure. Yeah,
who gets 82%?
No one.
Yeah, and so that's good. But there are strong far-right groups that don't like him. And they call, they even say things like he's a heretic, that he has betrayed the church. Ross Douthat, he writes for the New York Times. He's a convert to Catholicism. He's sort of the New York Times Catholic person, mm-hmm. you know. And he accused Pope Francis in his book and in his columns of purposely leading the Catholic Church to the edge of schism. That means schism means a sharp break. I mean, that's strong language, okay. you know. There's people who say that he's a heretic. So he's a polarizing figure, unfortunately, a man who wants dialogue, who wants to get along and wants to help us and bridge the gaps. He's always, don't build walls, build bridges. So anyway, I hope he stays alive.
Yeah, right.
He's old. He's getting up in years. Yeah. Now he's in a wheelchair. And,
yeah.
But I think he stands for the gospel. I mean, he stands with Jesus. let's live the way Jesus said to live. You know,
yeah.
It's just great stuff.
Yeah. The fourth lens before we get to the common ground piece that you were a part of was liberals versus conservative.
Yeah.
Which is kind of running through all the other three.
Yeah, it is. It's a different language for trying to describe the differences. It's using political language to describe Christian things. I'm not sure how helpful it is.
Yeah. I think it might, there's a little, not redundancy, but it is a thread in the other three lenses.
Yeah, for sure.
So the Common Ground Project, explain how you got involved in that.
Oh, yeah. That's that's back in the 90s. Right? I think it was, sorry, 92. Well, one day I got a call from Phil Murnian, a priest in New York, and he told me, he says, Cardinal Bernardine and I are leading a project called the Common Ground Project, and we're just going to have our first meeting, and we would like you to come and join us. I said, of course, I'd be honored to do that, which I did. I was in a group of, I'm guessing, in and out 20 people. Cardinal Bernardine was the clear leader. Mm-hmm. Phil Murnian, now deceased, was the moderator, brought it together. Bishop Malone was there, Bishop Robert Weakland, the Steinfels, Peter Steinfeld and his wife, wonderful. I'm forgetting a lot of people, but and we met a couple times a year for 4 years. I was so taken with Bernardine. He became one of my new heroes, wonderful man, calm and unassuming, and very open-minded, and so on. And we eventually produced a document, Church in Time of Peril, and it was designed to bring the Catholics in the country together. That was Bernardine's big things. The Catholic community is polarized right now. And we can't have that. That was Phil Murnian's driving passion. How are we going to get Catholics together?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way the call to be Catholic was finally published, I think, in 1996. We worked on it constantly, and in the background to it, we were always trying to figure out how do we get the conservative bishops to come on board with us. It was always in the background. How do we frame this so that the conservative bishops and theologians will come on board? And when Bernardine finally released the document, there were four cardinals who were on vacation together, and they all came back and made a separate statement saying, we don't need this dialogue, we need conversion. Knocking the whole project, the whole Common Ground Project, four cardinals. And it was really a blow. And Cardinal Bernardin typically had a news guy who said, well, they just proved my point. They just proved my point. We got a division, and they don't want a dialogue about it. They want to frame it differently.
So that the Four Cardinals' view was, we need to stay aligned with the traditional view or structures of the church.
And their language is, we need conversion, not dialogue.
What does that mean? Convert can mean
people? Conversion of heart. We need Catholics to get more with it. We need Catholics to listen to us.
Listen to us, not to each other.
Yeah. We need Catholics who are towing the line on official Vatican teaching, and which we tend to represent.
Right. So did your group re-meet again?
Oh, yeah. And the whole group, it still goes. The Common Ground Project still goes on. And we had a number of different meetings. There were some really good ones when we got conservative Catholics to come to participate, and we'd have a topic to discuss, authority in the church. And then Michael Novak, well-known neoconservative, Marianne Glendon from Harvard, another neoconservative, we got them to come to conferences and to discuss. So the whole idea was to how to get people in the room together. And it was very effective. I mean, it's hard to demonize somebody you just had dinner with, you know, and or had a good conversation with. That was the whole idea of it.
Has the sex abuse crisis, what has that done for the gap within the church? Has it brought people together, this idea we need to improve, or is it kind of people have gone, they have different views, they want to get it behind us?
It's hurt the church for sure.
For sure, yeah.
And very often the Catholic lay people have been more upset with the bishops than with the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's bad, but the bishops who supported the perpetrators and didn't want to bring it out into the public, that's really what caused the divide. Can I go back to Cardinal Bernardin?
You can, yes.
While we were doing this four-year thing, he was publicly accused. Oh, sex abuse, yeah.
Sex abuse.
Yeah, he was publicly accused by a seminarian young man of having abused him. Under hypnosis, the young man thought that Bernardin had accused him and abused him and so on. So that became public. The media jumped all over it. And what I admired about Bernardin is, I mean, it hurt him deeply, no doubt, but he maintained some what I called spiritual equilibrium. He maintained a certain enough distance to not get totally undone by it. And he simply said, it's not true. I've never abused anybody. And of course, the good news for him was that the young man said, yes, I was wrong. I falsely accused him. And he never did anything to me. And Bernardin, to his credit, flew to where the young man was and had mass with him, sort of forgave him. Yeah. So it was, in a sense, a great moment where some sort of virtue or positive message came out of a terrible situation.
Yeah. Anything else you want to bring up about the division within the Catholic Church or the trying to bridge that? It's still the point of the Common Project. Yeah. You have to learn, you have to have that dialogue.
Yeah, that's what we should do. There's things in my notes, I know, where I talk about called to be Catholic, Church in Time of Peril. What's the title of that again? That document I'm talking about.
I'm not sure what that is.
That I helped write. I'm forgetting the exact title. Church in Time of Peril.
Church in Time of Peril, right.
Yeah. So it said things like we have to not think that our side has a monopoly on the truth. If you start out with that, you're not going to get any place. No side has a monopoly on the truth. truth is God's truth. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and we're all in process of trying to move closer to that truth. That's why one of the ideas of dialogue is that if we're going to have a dialogue, then we're hoping to arrive at truth that's greater than either one of us has when we start, that we'll both see something we didn't see before. So we got to have dialogue, and we have to respect the other part. We don't have a monopoly on the truth. You said other things, too, in that section about take other people at their best and not at their worst. I mean, everybody makes statements. When you're fighting, or everyone makes statements that are outlandish or too far out. And what the document says is that take people at their best, not at their worst. Don't pin them to some stupid thing they said 2 years ago. You know, don't berate them with that. Take what it was that was good that they, and don't impute false motives to people. Don't say, well, you said that because you're out for political gain. Mm. So don't question people's motivation and so on. So there's a lot of great stuff in there in the Common Ground Project, called to be Catholic, Church in Time of Peril. One of the members of the committee wrote it, and back then it was total secrecy. When I went to meetings, I couldn't even tell my sister where I was going.
Why was it so secretive?
We were afraid that the media would get hold of it and blow it up before it got out.
Got it.
Yeah, great secrecy. Yeah. And I went out of my way to be faithful to that. My sister, I'll be gone a few days.
Where are you going, Jim?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm just out.
Yeah, I'm out. the secrecy was important. And the Common Project still goes on, and there's still meetings and so on. And we have made progress. And those rules for dialogue are good for dialogue between Catholics and Protestants, mm-hmm. between Catholics and Jews and Muslims. You know, that's good stuff. I mean, how do you talk to one another? Don't think you got all the truth.
There's some other people with some really good ideas and experiences.
Exactly. Yeah. Better be open to it.
Well,
yeah, one of the big things we said in there is don't let the Eucharist become a battleground and make it part of the Common Ground. How we celebrate the liturgy is very important.
Yeah.
The odd thing is, the bishops who, cardinals who attacked the document days after it came out, accused us of doing things that explicitly we said. In the document, we said that we have to be faithful to Jesus Christ. Now, Christ is our light, our guide. You know, we're going to make progress by being faithful to Him. And we said we have to be faithful to the long, rich, various Catholic tradition. Mm. That stuff was all in there. And they were accusing us of not putting that in there.
Yeah. And it seemed like it was very rewarding for you personally to be a part of that.
It was. It was a great honor to be part of it. It was a great honor to know Cardinal Bernardine.
Yeah.
I remember he came to Toledo and gave a talk, and I was there and greeted him and thanked him for his great courage. Part of what he did so well was to befriend death. He had cancer, knew death was coming, and he went out of his way to consult spiritual directors like Henry Nouwen and said, you must embrace death, befriend death, and that's what he did. So he kept working right up till near the end, visiting people who were sick and comforting the people who were suffering right up to the end. So he was faithful to his prayers. He had had an hour prayer time at the beginning of the day. His mother was infirm and elderly, and he visited her regularly. I mean, did all kind of good things. And some people have said he was the greatest churchman in the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. He was very involved in writing a pastoral letter on peace. So he was a real leader within the Bishops' Conference. something, very different kind of leader than we've had lately.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Father Basic, thank you for giving us once again some great ideas and thoughts and insights to spur our reflection and spiritual growth. This has been great. Thank you.
Thanks for leading, Brad. I rely on you.
You're very welcome.
I rely on you. Thank you.
You're very welcome.